anyway, I better get going here. Because I've done this a few times before. If you want to do that, I'll use the flashlight. Well, okay. If you can see it better, I'll force communication. So, yeah, okay.
I can read it.
Yeah, it is kind of chanting that long psalm on Maundy Thursday or whatever. So, because this is going to be dealing with music, I'm going to have to require you to listen to some music, and my presentation is based on it. I'm going to start off right away here. For many, this title, "The Theology of Music with a Question Mark," may be an oxymoron. Theology has to do with ideas, concepts, words, and expressions of language. As pastors, we evaluate the writings and babblings of others from a theological perspective. We listen intently to the words and expressions other people choose. Recognizing that people use words differently, we ascertain the meaning of an expression like the life of faith. We ask, we dialogue, we communicate theologically through the medium of human language. Hence, theology, as we know and experience it, is intrinsically bound to the spoken and written word. At first examination, music doesn't seem to fit this paradigm. As English speakers, we do not communicate solely on the basis of intonation. The pitch middle C does not have any special meaning in or of itself. Two pitches played simultaneously may convey the idea of dissonance and the desire to resolve this tension, or consonance. As we listen to music, we may notice that there is a fluctuation between dissonance and consonance. This tension the tension created by dissonance and the subsequent resolution brings direction or movement to the music. In other words, music is not static. Music may have a predominance of high or low notes, fast or slow notes, loud or soft passages, or thick or thin textures. Like some people who speak in a gruff manner, or others who speak with a soft, petite inflection, this voice may not communicate anything of itself. A particular tonal presentation may indicate the personality or likes or dislikes of a composer. When used in combination with one another, however, there may be something communicated. Like a literary composition, music may have themes and motifs. For instance, the great German composer Wagner wrote a musical theme called a Leitmotif for each one of his characters along with the emotions and props in his famous Ring. These musical themes interacted with one another along with the characters on the stage. Even in today's popular music, we can identify characters with themes through some participation. Ba-dum, da-dum, da-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum. Pink Panther, or dum, 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 ba-dum. So Darth Vader, the theme or the character of that. So you have an association with a particular character. Music is a form of communication. One possible way of describing how music communicates might be to compare two-dimensional art with three-dimensional. Instead of being on a two-dimensional plane like our spoken language, music exists in a three-dimensional space. In the movie Amadeus, the composer Mozart describes to his majesty the beginning of one of his operas. He speaks about a dialogue between two people. The maid enters, then somebody else. In a regular conversation, this would be chaos, mere noise. But in Mozart's opera, it is music. One could have, as in this case, 26 different conversations going on at the same time. Like the written and spoken word, music communicates concepts and ideas, albeit through a different set of rules. Instead of nouns, verbs, adjectives, and so on, music uses pitches, rhythms, harmonies, dynamic contrasts, and silences, all in combination with one another to communicate ideas and concepts to the listener. With this in mind, I believe it behooves us to examine music with the same critical apparatus as we do the written and spoken word. For the purpose of this paper, I'd like to propose three theses. It is my intent to demonstrate through these theses through the use of two diametrically opposed examples, which are from two different genres, none of which are Christian. I do that because I don't want to get into this big debate right away on Christian music and all that. I ask you, and plead with you as we do this, that you listen from the perspective not of like or dislike, but rather from the perspective of the composer. As we listen to a person and ignore the distractions of accent or other vocal characteristics, so we must do the same thing with music. Listen and ask yourself, perhaps for the first time, what is the composer trying to communicate through music that he or she has written? Thesis 1. Music behaves much like human language. In other words, music communicates ideas and concepts through its vocabulary, grammar, and syntax, namely through silence, pitch, rhythm, harmonization, dynamics, and how they are used with one another. Since music behaves like our human languages, we must evaluate it like any other language. Therefore, we must be aware of music's ability to communicate, whether it's through its own emphasis or through an association to something else. And since both human language and music have the ability to communicate theologically, music could provide a conflicting message with the words of a text. Therefore, music must subordinate itself to serve the words of a text. And I'm thinking in those terms of a sacred text. So, I don't know if this would be the right place to put this music here, because the next example you're going to see, you're going to really question me here. My first musical example, Frank Zappa. Bet you didn't think you were going to get that, huh? In our first musical example, we'll explore the musical composition by Frank Zappa. Like many of Zappa's musical compositions, this song is highly sarcastic. The sarcasm is not only found in the words of the lyrics, but also in the music itself. If we listen carefully, we will hear a dialogue between the narrator, the person singing the lyrics, and Andy, the person who the song is about. Andy responds, not with words, but with a musical theme that is easily recognizable, at least if you were living in the 70s, the theme of a TV soap opera. Zappa employs both internal and external associations to create a dialogue between the narrator and Andy. First of all, Zappa creates an internal association by using an unusual rhythm that introduces the first question. Because it stands out from everything else, when this rhythmic theme returns later without words, the listener can easily hear the question, "Is there anything good inside of you? If there is, I really want to know." Later, after Andy responds with his sad response, the soap opera theme, the question is sarcastically rephrased, "Do you know what I'm really telling you? Is it something you can understand?" At the beginning of the song, Zappa creates another internal association by introducing the theme of something, anything. After the initial question, this theme is then associated with the words something, anything. The same theme follows three more times without words in this competition, once repeating the theme and then after the unusual rhythmic question theme, as I've already talked about. Zappa also uses external associations when he restates the first question in a simple blues progression. Zappa drops the complex rhythmic activity to give the impression that he's asking the question as simply as possible. The climax is Andy's response. Again, Zappa makes a clear external association to the theme of a popular TV soap opera. Unable to verbalize an answer, Andy's only response is the mindless chatter of modern-day television, which happens to be one of Zappa's favorite themes in his music. Through the use of associations, Zappa creates a dialogue that, for the inattentive person, might be characterized by hearing one side of the conversation. The written lyrics are almost like listening to a person talk to the phone to another person. The music provides the other side of the dialogue. The following are the lyrics to the song. The brackets that you'll see at the top will alert you to the musical themes and hopefully enable you to hear the dialogue between the narrator and Andy. And so I'm going to ask you to experience something you probably never have before. So here's the song, and I will...
Thank you.
I told you it was sarcastic, so. For our next part, we're going to explore a totally different composition from an entirely different genre. And though the styles, instruments, and subject matter may differ, both composers not only use lyrics, but music to communicate their message to us, the listener. Again, I wish to reiterate the need for us not to be swayed by the likes or dislikes of a composer's style, but to listen to the music from the perspective of the composer. In order to facilitate this, I'm going to imagine that we're preparing to write a funeral sermon. Assume for a moment you've been given this text from 1 Peter. For all flesh is as grass, and all the glory of a man as the flower grass. The grass withereth, and the flower thereof falls away, but the word of the Lord endureth forever. I would do this if we had more time, spend some more time, but just as we look at this text, maybe to ask the question, what is the main thought of this text? All flesh is as grass, and the glory of man is the flower of grass, so forth. And what words in this text would you emphasize for the law? What words would you emphasize for the gospel? And then, having done that, and you do this on a regular basis as pastors who have to do this, maybe you've never used this text before for a funeral, imagine if you're asked to put it to music. What mood would you have for the law? And how might you highlight the law using music? What mood would you use for the gospel? How might you highlight the gospel? There's a move we usually don't do as pastors, but just I want you to get in that kind of frame. How would you put this to music?
Right? In a sense that it's based on your preaching.
Yeah.
All based on your subjective response.
Yeah. Well, we'll see how one person does it here. Johannes Brahms in Deutsches Requiem, the German Requiem, and dealing with the second movement, All Flesh is as Grass. In our second musical example, we explore the second movement of the German Requiem of Johannes Brahms. The word Requiem traditionally refers to the Roman Catholic Mass for the dead. The name comes from the opening Latin phrase of the introit, grant them eternal rest, O Lord. In his selection of texts for his Requiem, Brahms avoided the liturgical Roman Catholic text entirely. While the traditional Latin Requiem is a plea for the peace of the souls of the dead, Brahms' Requiem seeks to provide comfort for the bereaved. Like our Lutheran theology, Brahms rejected the concept of purgatory along with many of the other elements of the Roman Rite. Although an avid student of the Lutheran Bible, Brahms was not an Orthodox believer. You wouldn't want to use this piece in church. For instance, one musicologist notes that Brahms avoids all mention of Christ in the selected text, though at times the word Lord clearly refers to the Messiah of the New Testament. One critic challenged Brahms on this point by suggesting that he extend his work to introduce a more overtly Christian note. However, Brahms declined to change it, indicating that he was reluctant to be tied down by doctrinal matters. And he does it on that text we just looked at. Brahms began writing his Requiem in 1855 in the aftermath of his mentor's, Robert Schumann's, suicide, and completed it in 1868. And while many musicologists have linked the writing of this Requiem to the death of Schumann or Brahms' mother, it appears that Brahms throughout his life was obsessed by human mortality. This is one of many compositions Brahms wrote on the subject of death and mourning. In fact, you see elements of the same symphony in his early D minor symphony. Like many composers, Brahms used many devices to create a mood. One of them is the switch between major and minor keys. The minor key often presents a somber, melancholy type of mood, whereas the major key often presents a joyful, bright type of mood. In the overall structure of the second movement of Brahms' Requiem, note how Brahms switches between major and minor keys to create different moods. And you can see that as I have it outlined up here. Many of us can remember the TV game show called Name That Tune. Based on some clues about a composer or musical composition, the contestants would challenge one another by saying, I can name that tune and so many notes. Brahms begins his second movement with two notes that bring to mind a melody that is associated with death. The bass, as you see under A there, example A there, plays two notes from the tune Taps, or Day is Done. This external association from the outset sets forth the concept of mortality. Brahms introduces a theme in the melody that also conveys the idea of death. If we focus on the melody as it's played in the violin, that top line there, where you see B kind of highlighted there, the movement is propelled by a dissonance that seeks resolution. It's a downward motion there. This pattern is repeated two times until the final resolution. This line might be compared to the physical setbacks a person may have in life, where one's physical prowess is slowly diminished by an injury. There may be a recovery, but one never attains the previous level. Brahms makes use of a march-like rhythm. Unlike Sousa's marches, the ones that we're used to in duple meter, Brahms puts this march in triple meter. In triple meter, the strong beat is always on beat one. One, two, three. When the resolution takes place on a strong beat, like it does on C right there, one feels a sense of certainty. When the same resolution occurs on a weak beat on two or three, like it does later down here on where E is, and who's the other one? You have the feeling of uncertainty. Just as we confess death to be a mystery, there's an element of uncertainty about this event. Brahms conveys this sense of uncertainty in placing the ending resolution on the weak beat. To propel the above dissonance even further, Brahms uses the timpani figure in D there. The triplet figure is followed by two quarter notes, and it may be said to convey the idea of a heartbeat. At the end of the phrase, the triplet is dropped, and the quarter notes are separated by rest to give the impression of withering away, where you see E there. And I'll play a brief example.
A note here, the instruments I'm using here, or what you're hearing, is actually generated by a music compositional program that I use to put this called Finale, and they've actually electronically given you a violin, double bass, and timpani here. So,
first theme, after the introduction, is the accompaniment of the first setting, that introduction to the words of 1 Peter 1:24. In this melody, we note how the majority of notes are within a step of one another. There are no large leaps except for the words Gras and Blumen. And finally, on Augefallen, you see that large leap there. Notice how Brahms paints the picture of falleth away, Augefallen, and he makes this word the highest and longest note of the phrase, and again resolves it on the weak beat, B2. So here's this theme. Thank you. And then you have agapalin right here. To bring about a sense of hope in the midst of sorrow, Brahms changes keys from B-flat minor to G-flat major. Unlike the previous melody, this melody consists mostly of skips, jumps of thirds and fourths. The mood is quite different, an encouragement to wait with the eager expectation for the coming of the Lord. It's taken from James 5:7. Be patient, therefore, brethren, unto the coming of the Lord. Behold, the husband waiteth for the precious fruit of the earth, and have long patience for it until he receive the early and the latter rain. So here's the next one. That noise out there, I don't know. Having given a glimpse of encouragement, the first theme returns, and we find ourselves again in the key of B-flat minor. This is not a mere The section repeats exactly the introduction in first theme. Having withered away to nothing, we come to the climax of this movement. In order to convey the idea of victory over gloom and sorrow, Brahms changes the key from B-flat minor to B-flat major. A dramatic statement is made, but the word of the Lord endures forever. Brahms adds emphasis by repeating blibit, and then quoting eggtight, forever, forever. Undergirding this long note and adding excitement is the fanfare played by the trumpet, flute, and oboe. Brahms provides hope by continuing in the key of B-flat major. The theme introduced by the trumpet in the climax is now taken up by the voice. The dotted rhythm, along with the large leaps, convey a sense of joy. And one of the characteristics of this is that you see one of the key words here, and do I have it here, Freude, is used, joy is highlighted quite a bit in this last part of this movement. Having finished now with the preparatory work of listening to two different musical compositions from two divergent genres, so I now begin to discuss the three theses with which I began this paper. Having stated each thesis, I will give an example from the two musical compositions you have heard to support the validity of each thesis. Thesis 1, music behaves much like human language. In other words, music communicates ideas and concepts through its vocabulary, grammar, and syntax, namely through silence, pitch, rhythm, harmonization, dynamics, and how they are used with one another. Just as a word does not have a meaning apart from a context, so the same thing is true with music. If we would look up the word dog in any modern English dictionary, one could find over 20 different meanings to this word. It could mean, as it often does, a domestic canine, but it may also refer to a detestable man or youth. It could express that something is extremely poor quality, that used car you bought is a dog, it could be said that someone is dogging it, loafing on the job. A person might even be called a lucky dog. In these cases, the context determines the meaning of the word used. The same thing is true with music. While an individual note does not convey any particular meaning by itself, it does within a musical context. In Brahms' example, we saw and heard how the timpani rhythm can convey the idea of a heartbeat. As Brahms communicates the idea of death in the final resolution, the timpani drops the triplet rhythm and uses rest to convey the idea of death. Again, in the same musical example, the downward motion with the successive dissonances resolving on the strong beat convey the idea of withering away. We saw and heard how a resolution occurring on a strong beat brings a feeling of certainty. However, the end of the phrase, when Brahms resolves the dissonance on a weak beat, there's a sense of uncertainty, the sense of nothingness. We also notice the difference in mood as Brahms switched from minor to major, first as he tried to bring encouragement, and then in the climax he highlighted our hope. The stepwise motion of the melancholy theme of Denn alles Fleisch stands in contrast to the leaps of the themes of the one that was from James and then from the one from Isaiah there. And while these musical themes may not mean anything in isolation from one another, within the context of this composition, they convey either the gravity of our mortality or the hope of God's deliverance. Within the context of this composition, Brahms conveys the frightening idea of the uncertainty of death and our future restoration through the use of the vocabulary, syntax, and grammar of music. In all the above examples, these concepts are conveyed even when there are no lyrics. Again, we see and hear how Brahms uses pitches, rhythm, harmony, dynamic contrast, and silences, all in combination with one another, to communicate ideas and concepts to the listener. Thesis 2. Since music behaves like our modern human languages, we must evaluate it like any other language. Therefore, we must be aware of music's ability to communicate, whether it's through its own emphases or through an association to something else. Our written and oral languages convey thoughts and ideas not only through vocabulary and the rules of grammar of that particular language, but also through the associations with things that do not seem to have much in common with the subject matter at hand. A common form of communication is a simile or metaphor. In a simile, we associate two things that are not generally like each other. She is like a rose. A metaphor, on the other hand, associates to representation. A mighty fortress is our God. These and other figures of speech are some of the ways we communicate abstractions to others. This is especially true in the realm of theology. Oftentimes we find ourselves struggling to find the right language to describe the indescribable. So we use a figure of speech to associate God with a thing we know. In doing this, we take great care in choosing our words. Associations have theological ramifications. They either embrace truth or error. So for the theologian, the words or figures of speech connected with a confession of God is not a matter of indifference. It is, rather, something of great significance. The same thing is true with the language of music. In Brahms' second movement of his German Requiem, we heard how Brahms makes an external association to death with the melody of Pan. Through a musical figure of speech, Brahms conveys the idea of human mortality. In Frank Zappa's song, Andy, Zappa creates a dialogue with the narrator, the one singing the lyrics, and the person of Andy by the use of internal and external musical associations. The unusual nine-tuplet rhythm that matches the rhythm of the Is There Anything Good Inside of Me question is associated and identified with the words of this question even when the lyrics are silent. The introduction of the song is soon associated with the words something, anything. When this musical theme is repeated without lyrics, one cannot help but hear the words associated with this theme. Finally, the climax of the song is a clear external association. Andy's response is the musical theme from a TV soap opera. All these associations help to heighten the sarcasm of this composition. In fact, it is precisely those who are inattentive to these musical figures of speech and the dialogue they create that fall prey to vapid, sardonic sarcasm. Like the spoken and written word, the composer of music uses musical similes or metaphors to create ideas or concepts for the listener. Just as a poet is not indifferent about the words he or she chooses, so the same thing is true of the music composer. So as we have seen, composers are deliberate in choosing their associations or musical figures of speech. To be indifferent toward these associations is naive. Just as words are not theologically neutral, so music is not theologically neutral. And finally, the last thesis. Since both human language and music have the ability to communicate theologically, music could provide a conflicting message with the words of a text. Therefore, music must subordinate itself to serve the words of the text. Listening is one of the great skills a pastor can possess, for a good listener does not merely listen to the words spoken, but also takes note of the congruence, or lack thereof, in the body language and tone of voice. For instance, imagine that a person has just told you, "I love you." As you heard these words, you may have pictured your spouse or someone you like to have as your spouse speaking these words to you. But imagine for a moment that the same person is now screaming, "I love you," while standing an inch in front of your face and covering you with spittle. In this picture, we are receiving two different messages at the same time. There is a lack of congruence between what is actually said and how it is said. The same thing is true when a composer puts music to a text. The composer of music places a high priority on the congruence between the words and lyrics and the music itself. He or she does this knowing full well that music can and does convey ideas and concepts of its own. In his German Requiem, Brahms sets the text of "All Flesh is as Grass" not only in a minor key to convey the melancholy mood and the words, but also paints these words with the musical line. The stepwise motion of the melody line highlights the idea of futility and mortality. He paints the picture of falleth away by emphasizing the word agafallen with a supporting musical falling and resolving on the weak beat. In his climax, Brahms changes the mood by setting the text to B flat minor. Here, Brahms paints the picture of the word forever by holding this word for 10 beats, the longest note in this movement. Zappa does the same thing with his question theme. Because the words of his initial question have 9 syllables, he puts the music in the form of a complex 9-couplet rhythm. When the narrator asks the question again, Zappa simplifies it by putting it into a simple blues progression. Zappa wants congruence between how the narrator asks the question in the lyric and how the supporting music affirms the same message. When the question is restated with different words after Andy's sad response, the original complex 9-couplet rhythm is used 4 more times in succession. The music not only perfectly follows the syllables of the word of the question, it also serves to highlight and set the question apart from the rest of the piece. From the composer's standpoint, the genesis of a composition starts from the words of the text. These words determine the musical theme, the setting, major or minor key, the melodic lines, rhythm, harmonization, and the various other techniques that composers may use to bring out the features of the text. For Brahms, this meant spending over 12 years laboring to put music to the text he selected for his Requiem. In both examples, we clearly saw and heard a high level of congruence between the text and the music. This just did not happen by accident. Rather, there was a deliberate and purposeful attempt by each composer to set their music to the words they had chosen. Hence, we see a subordination of the music to the words of the text. If this is true with secular and humanistic musical composition, how much more should we be concerned with the congruence between the words of theology and the music that accompanies the lyrics? Therefore, it behooves us to examine music with the same critical apparatus as we do the words of a text. We need to ask, what is the text saying? What words or phrases is the music bringing to the fore? And are these the right emphases? And is there congruence between the music and the lyrics? Or are there mixed messages being sent? Here ends my presentation. So. And if you're interested, you can get Brahms' German Requiem. There's a number of good recordings of Robert Shaw. Recording is very good. I like the James Levine, the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, probably the best of all of them, but it is a very interesting composition. And it's much better with the original instruments than having these electronic. Yeah.
Let's take, if you're going to do a movie, or you're going to do a Billy and the Island or something, can you just search me for it?
Well, you're putting, I don't know if I want to go in that direction yet.
Don't be specifically, if you're going to have a scene for a
Yeah, and that's very, you see that very deliberately in music, in the movies. So, when you're coming to church music, you're dealing with a whole host of things that I think are problematic. You have associations to things in the world. Are those associations going to be carried by the music? And is it going to be, in that sense, there are confliction here? That's, I think, kind of what I'm trying to put, I'm trying to answer it.
You can take Billy and the Island, I mean, we all know what it is. Mm-hmm. You know, and you can put that to the words, and it would absolutely make a difference.
Well, I haven't done it. Or what are you thinking of? I've heard people do it with amazing grace. Oh. I don't know how it would work out. Where would the emphasis be, you know, if you put it that way? Well, that's the other thing there, too. But the thing that I was putting out in my last point is that, for instance, we do this in our hymnals quite a bit. We have one melody, and then we have words, and we put those words on another melody. Now, does it bring out the right emphasis in the text? That would be one of my criticisms of TLH, because they do that with a lot of hymns, where they take a hymn, and then they take that melody, and then since it's in that meter, and your organist can't play it in that weird hymn, they'll put it in and do it a more singable hymn, but then the emphasis gets shifted by the music. So, I'm not answering your question.
No,
directly.
I'm trying to
Yeah.
Does music set the mood, a particular mood scene? Or does the music theme give us an image by which we are attached to that music?
You're asking on the genesis of it, kind of, are you? And,
it could be either way.
I don't know. I suppose it's different from different people how they put together a movie. Maybe they're thinking of a scene before, but I think most of the movies, I haven't studied how they do it. I followed a little bit of the Star Wars, how they did the music there, but they did all the scenes beforehand, and John Williams wrote the music after. You know, he wrote it after they did all the production, and then they put it to the finished product there. And so it seemed like it would be the same kind of emphasis here, where you have words, and then you write the music. And there it was, the movie, and then they did the music. So, but I could see that they could probably do it the other way too, but I just, you know.
Kubrick's 2001.
Was that? Yeah, they did it with Hobbit's Blockbuster.
Well, he chose various pieces that he was familiar with as temporary pieces, and was going to have somebody actually compose something different.
Mm-hmm.
But then when he got to listening to what the composer had done, the Hollywood composer had done, with these various scenes, he went back to his original choices that he had chosen before he actually shot the film and put the images together. Mm-hmm. In particular, the one that I remember most from this discussion was that his choice of the Blue Danube for the approach to the space station. Mm-hmm. That was the one that he had given the composer the challenge to do this. Some other ones I can't remember the other science fiction movie where, again, they tried to present the music and have the music lead you into the imagery and even give you a musical cue to what was going to be coming next.
But he probably did his movie based on that prior musical example kind of image.
Yeah.
And that would be an example where the music probably came first.
Right.
Genesis. And
there's also been a group of various people who would take a movie or even something like a video game that has a very in-depth storyline to it. And they'll take the video from that, and then they'll replace the audio with their own audio track, put in new lines, new music and everything. And I've heard that you can take movies, and they're available on the internet somewhere, you can Google them, and it'll, where it drastically changes even the genre of the movie.
Uh-huh.
By replacing the dialogue and stuff, even though the visual is the same.
There was a lady, and they had her on public radio station, local. I don't know if it's what one would listen to, but it's KUFI or whatever. I can't remember. Mm-hmm. She was doing a special, kind of something similar to this, where she was taking Christmas carols and switching the words from them, kind of like what Dave's first question was here. She took Silent Night and put the words of Santa Claus is Coming, and it was absolutely terrifying to sing. You know, you better be good. I mean, imagine singing that to your kids. It's actually hilarious. And well, one composer makes a living doing this. If you've ever followed the works of Peter Schickele under his pseudonym P.D.Q. Bach, he does this with musical themes. There is associations like the 1712 Overture or the 1812 Overture. He puts pop goes to musical. And it's like, and it's humorous because they don't belong together. It's an incongruence that he is basing his composition on, and we know that these things don't belong in that sense.
Listen to him every Sunday night.
But a lot of those associations are developed and are part of our experience. I'm wondering if you would have played that music this afternoon with no words, and all of us would have sat down and listened to it and tried to put our interpretation to the music, mm-hmm. how many different interpretations we would have gotten from the super people. I don't know, and I don't know if there have been studies.
Manfred Klein, Adelaide, Australia,
mm-hmm.
set up a study where he took aboriginals from the outback and white European types, played them music, and concocted a way for them to interpret the music without using words, without using verbal language, and they interpreted it by.
Anyway, what I've shown here is just what we learned. I spent 3 years of music theory in my undergraduate, and this is basically basic music theory that you learn in a music school, that there are certain things you look for, and even musical outwards is communicating something. You look, these things are patterned and they're taught in music theory. I mean, this isn't anything really that revolutionary or anything new in that
music therapy. It's a standard subject, and it's a broadly used thing. You take certain pieces of music for certain purposes in therapy.
Mm-hmm. For example, I couldn't even pick out the theme from the soap opera.
Yeah.
I would not have really looked at it at all. I would not have made that association.
Well, part of it, when you do it from the perspective of a composer or whatever, you have to know a little bit about the composer's too and some of that. I can't tell you exactly what the soap opera theme is, but this is a continually a theme that Zappa plays on throughout his music. He and this is, you know, he's making a statement, which is continually one of his major statements in his music, where he is you know, sarcastic in talking about the attitude of people who watch TV, that they're mindless, they have nothing to offer and suffering. And I mean, this was in the 70s, you know, so.
That's a good picture right there.
No, leave her alone.
My daughter.
You know, the thought that came to mind when you were playing Zappa, and again, it's a thought of the wall or not, but in Zappa's time in the 70s, this was also the same time that Jesus Christ Superstar came out.
Yeah.
And that same sort of thematic theme that you had with Zappa is also very similar to Jesus Pilot, Herod type of interaction as well. So that's just the flavor of that style and that time of the music.
Yeah. But there is I used it as an extreme example to show a dialogue where one side isn't even speaking. And that's the whole purpose of this kind of music.